Okay, welcome back, everyone. My name is Siobhan Harris. I'm the Bureau Chief for Medicaid Policy. I'm standing in for Beth Kidder. She had to be out of the office on an urgent business-related matter. So I'm going to turn it over to Carla Sims to do roll call.
Cheryl Young with Department of Health.
Cheryl Young, Department of Health. Jerry Cully with Department of Children and Families.
Diana Lowe before her.
Thank you. Madeline Nobles with Department of Elder Affairs.
Here.
Crystal Stickle with Florida Hospital Association.
Here.
Amy Guyan-Liam with Florida Legal Services.
Here.
Anyone from Chain? Dr. Moffitt?
Here.
Dr. Thacker? Dr. Payne for the Florida Dental Association?
Here.
Stan Whitaker? Michael Lockwood?
Here.
Iris Wimbush? Martha Pierce, Sarah Sequencia. We do have minutes to go over, but we do not have a quorum, so we are not able to vote on the minutes at this time.
Okay, thank you, Carla. Okay, so we are going to move into the new business portion of the agenda. First on the agenda is program updates. So a couple changes have happened since our last MCAC meeting. Justin Senior, our interim secretary, was appointed as our secretary. We're very happy that change took place. And also Beth Kidder, who was also serving in an interim role as the deputy secretary for Medicaid, was appointed as the deputy secretary for Medicaid. So everyone has removed their interim titles and are settling into their roles. We wanted to also make you aware that at the end of last year, we submitted two legislatively mandated reports. They are available on our website. We were mandated by the legislature to submit a report around revenue maximization to see new ways and opportunities to secure additional federal funding for behavioral health services. So that report was developed by the agency in consultation and with great coordination from staff at the Department of Children and Families. And so that report is available on our website. We also had to submit a report related to the NPPS. Around the payment methodology for nursing facility services, so moving to a prospective payment system. I won't get into too much of that because that's not my area of expertise, but we contracted with Navigant, who worked extensively with agency staff to look at different models for the agency's consideration. There were several public meetings that were held in preparation of submitting the report, and that report was submitted to the legislature on December 30th. A couple other updates for the committee. We received federal approval on our long-term care 1915 BC waiver combo for the long-term care program. So, yay! It took several months of negotiations with CMS, but we are happy and pleased to continue our federal authority for that program. Also, at the end of the year, we submitted our renewal request on our Managed Medical Assistance 1115 waiver. We did receive feedback from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that our waiver application was complete, and they are in the midst of their federal comment period. So for those of you who are not familiar with how the process works, we historically have engaged in a transparent open and public comment period where stakeholders can submit comments to the agency before we submit the document up to CMS. We did that late last year. We submitted the document to CMS, and now they have a 30-day window where they open it up for stakeholder feedback and comments. So we anticipate that will close mid-February, I believe, right,
yes.
Chantal?
April 10th.
Okay, February 8th or 10th. Also of interest to you all, we did get some feedback from CMS that they should be letting us know or sending us some initial questions finally on our amendment request on the 1115 waiver to cover temporary housing assistance services for individuals with serious mental illness and substance use disorders who are also contending with homelessness. If you recall, during last legislative session, the legislature appropriated funding, about $10 million, for the agency to implement those new services through its managed care program. We held a couple public meetings on the matter and submitted our waiver amendment to CMS in October. And we've been waiting with bated breath for their feedback. And we were told last month in January that feedback will be coming soon. So I wish I had more to share, but it is promising that one day soon we will get questions. We will keep you posted as our negotiations with the feds continue on that matter or start on that matter. That was it for me. I think any questions on that before we move on? Yes, Amy.
Thanks. This is Amy Lean with Florida Legal Services. Okay. I just had a question about the waiver renewal request that you submitted at the end of the year at our last MCAC meeting. We discussed it and we reviewed a draft. And it was my understanding that what you actually submitted now is changed from the 3-year renewal request to a 5-year. And I was just curious if maybe you could kind of give us an update on the reasoning behind that and maybe highlight any other significant changes to the draft that we reviewed.
Sure. So I think there were really only two major changes from the draft. The first was the fact that we, instead of asking for three years, asked for 5. So as a part of the public comment questions, we received an inquiry as to whether or not the state could ask for a 5-year extension, and we reached out to CMS. Historically, CMS has advised that 3 years is the maximum amount of time that would be approved on an extension. But we reached out, and they indicated that you're more than welcome to ask for 5, and they didn't see any reason why 5 years would not be approvable. So we went ahead and asked for the 5. Prefer to not have to renew as many times if we can avoid it. And then the only other change is we did in the final document that went up ask for continuance of the LIP, the low income pool program, as it stands here today. So we're asking for the same programmatic and federal authorities that we currently have for the LIP program, and that was also based on comments that we received both orally and in writing from interested stakeholders.
Great, thank you. And just one quick follow-up. Will the actual document, the final draft, be posted on the ACA website soon?
So I'm going to turn to Chantel. Carter-Jones. Chantel is the administrator over our federal authorities section. Not to put you on the spot, but...
I speak really loudly, so I hope I don't bust some eardrums. It should already be there. I'll go back and double-check. I believe it was posted, though.
If so, it's been very recent.
Okay, if it's not up there, we will make sure that it is up there. It's our intent and goal to have it up there. Any other questions from the MCAC members? Okay, if not, we'll move into our next agenda topic, the Comprehensive Quality Strategy Report, presented by Marie Donnelly.
Good afternoon. I'm Marie Donnelly. I'm the Bureau Chief for Medicaid Quality here at the agency, and I'd like to just give you a little update on our Comprehensive Quality Strategy Report. This document is required by federal CMS And rather than just make it an administrative document, we're trying to make it more useful and informative and give more updates for what we're actually practically doing to move the needle on quality measures. The report includes an outline of our priorities and goals for quality improvement, specific quality metrics and performance targets that we use to measure performance and continuous improvement. It's not a static thing. We also publish those quality metrics and comparisons on the agency's website, and they're also available in a consumer-friendly format on the Choice Counseling website. Thank you. And as I mentioned, updates and on the performance improvement projects and quality cycle activities that we're undertaking to promote our goals. The priorities are improved health outcomes. That's really the bottom line. And you'll hear simplified and streamlined a lot. That's one of the agency's major objectives for all activities. Because we want service delivery to be efficient, timely, and appropriate. We want services to be person-centered and family-centered. And we want, again, another agency priority, accountability and transparency for all our efforts. And finally, we want to improve care coordination. Major quality goals that are our recent focus are birth outcomes and related care, children's dental health, consumer engagement, so we have informed consumers in their choice of health plan and their choices of health services, continuous measurable improvement, and to reduce preventable hospitalizations. Today I'd like to mention feature four examples of some of the initiatives that we've undertaken to promote these goals. The first will be stakeholder collaborations to implement best practices in healthcare. Next, technical assistance for the health plans in their performance improvement projects, which are required as part of the MMA contract. We want to provide transparency and publish the health plan performance comparisons to inform consumers and other stakeholders. And finally, the physician incentive program that I think was mentioned earlier. The first example is stakeholder collaboration, and one major effort this year and for the next couple of years is improving birth outcomes and related services, where really everyone in the state is a stakeholder here. Medicaid pays for about 63% of the births in Florida. For about 14,800 babies who were born who required NICU, that was $801 million of cost for Medicaid. Of those women who gave birth, 74,000 received eligibility for Medicaid because they were pregnant. They weren't eligible before they became pregnant. And the research has shown, surveys and research, and asking the actual moms, that half of these pregnancies were unplanned. One example of the stakeholder collaborative initiative that we've undertaken is to promote awareness and access to long-acting reversible contraception. LARCS, L-A-R-C-S, as some of you may be familiar with that acronym. It's one of the most effective forms for people to be able to plan their pregnancies, and then, of course, coupled with reproductive life counseling, so a woman can make her reproductive life plan. The next step, we want to make sure that contraception is available if that's the choice.
So there are quite a few stakeholders involved here. For example, with we include the HEDIS measure standards for prenatal postpartum and early child measures in the MMA contracts. We require performance improvement projects within those contracts, and we have actual teams within the Quality Bureau at Medicaid that work with each health plan to help make rapid cycle improvement on those. We don't wait for the whole year's HEDIS measure cycle to do something. We've worked really hard with our external quality review organization contractor to work directly with health plans to show how they can test interim results, how they can make rapid cycle improvement, and actually move the needle during the whole measurement cycle so we don't have to wait until the HEDIS measurements the next time around. We've worked very closely with the Department of Health to increase the awareness and access to LARCs through county health departments, through their pharmacies. They've made some big changes over the past year. And here within Medicaid, we've been able to make some policy changes that removed barriers within some of our payment systems for these devices so that women may even be able to access those immediately after delivery in the hospital if they so choose. There were some barriers to that before. We coordinate, of course, with the Healthy Start coalitions in each community. We're promoting awareness and use of the family planning waiver, which allows people to have Medicaid coverage for 2 years after a birth. Even if they lose state plan coverage, they can still have contraception, family planning, and certain GYN services covered through Medicaid for the next 2 years. The healthy behaviors parts of the contracts also help support this, and the OBGYN part of the physician incentive program also supports these goals. I mentioned the PIP teams. That was new this year. Those are teams of people from the Quality Bureau. Some are clinical background. Some are monitoring background, but they all work together specifically with the health plan to help them move the needle on their performance improvement projects. And the two this year that we worked on are the prenatal and birth and dental services for children. We have found in we've gotten feedback from the health plans that they did want to share ideas and best practices and interim results on their performance improvement. They have taken advantage of the hands-on technical assistance. They are now using the quality improvement tools, and they like to have feedback within that before the whole HEDIS cycle to know how to make rapid changes to, if something's not working, to change things around. As we went through that process with the health plans on the dental PIPs, we helped them assess their barriers and their interventions. We were able to bring in information from all kinds of stakeholders. There are federal technical assistance groups that have helped other states. Other states have shared their progress, successes, and failures with us. We were able to share that with health plans and actually go out and meet with them face-to-face. And we've seen some really good results from that. One of the things that we learned that we needed to do with that was consumer engagement regarding dental services. There was a lack of awareness on the part of many recipients that those services are covered. So we were able to learn that. We learned from other states that having a recognizable logo or symbol would help a great deal, that told the story that, yes, it's covered. And our objective with the one that we designed was to promote awareness of the dental benefit across all health plans. So this is a logo that's used by all the health plans. So anyone who's any child in Medicaid knows that that is a covered service, and health plans are using it in their materials. And also, we wanted to get the message across that this is not just a cosmetic thing like pretty smile. This is definitely important for health. And we want that message to get to moms and young children. The number one infectious disease for children is tooth decay. So that is just so we all have a stake here in that. Along with transparency and accountability, many of you have probably seen that we are publishing health plan performance comparisons. The health plans submit their audited HEDIS scores each year. They have their CAP surveys, the child health checkup data that's reported to federal CMS on the 416 reports. Provider and recipient satisfaction survey results. Those are posted on our website, and I believe this in your packets. All of these links are included, so they're posted several places depending on where a person may look on the Choice Counseling website, on the Florida Health Finder website. And you can actually get a lot more detailed information on the Medicaid webpage if you want to see more detail on those HEDIS measures. And, of course, anyone from our staff will be happy to talk to you about that. Rachel LaCroix, Katie Black, very knowledgeable with those things. And then the fourth example of the initiatives that we're taking to promote the goals is the new physician incentive program that was implemented this year. As you know, that was in statute, which was very timely. CMS is looking at many ways to work toward value-based purchasing for Medicare and Medicaid, and this is a really good start. We're thinking about a different way to pay for services out of the old fee-for-service mold. Under the Florida program, the payments are to be funded from savings. The physician incentive program was developed with lots of input from each health plan. Weeks and weeks. I see some people around the room nodding. I mean, it was brand new, so we didn't want to just top down say this is how it's going to be. We wanted to gather all the ideas that we could. We got some very good ideas. We learned what the health plans were already doing, and we gave a choice that the agency developed a proposal that could be the default if the plan didn't want to come up with another one, or if they liked the agency's better, or they could use their own approved plan. So that those are in place now. The first group of physicians that were included this year, the pediatricians and OBGYNs, but other physician types, can be added in the future. One of the big things that weighted heavily in these programs is the patient-centered medical home model. That really emphasizes the patient-centered care that we have as one of the goals, and also the MPIP, of course, promotes the value-based care objective. The draft report is out at this link, so you can see it. We are in the comment period on that. We would really appreciate your input. If there's something that you would like to see that's not there, please let us know about it. We look forward to that. Any questions?
I have a few.
Mm-hmm.
Hold on, let me get back to my notes. When you were discussing the ability or that you've been promoting the use of LARC Are all of the MMA plans covering that and providing that now?
Yes.
Okay, and are you working statewide, or is there a pilot that you're working on?
I haven't
had any of our hospitals say that they've been having this covered under their plans at this
time.
Yeah,
and that's an excellent point, because it does involve if they want to provide it immediately post-delivery in the hospital, there's some pretty significant internal operating changes that have to happen at the hospital. There is a pilot now in Jacksonville, mm-hmm. with UF Shands. Mm-hmm. Two of the health plans there are involved, the Magnolia Project, Healthy Start. About a dozen stakeholders are involved with that. And the hope was to work through those changes that need to happen in the hospital. Of course, the medical staff, nursing staff, pharmacy staff, mm-hmm. procurement people, billing people all need to understand what's going on. And then very importantly, the timing of having the right device at the right place in the hospital for insertion. And these are the implants in the arm, not just IUD. Some people confuse that. But that pilot is underway, and there's also a quality improvement project that's being Dr. Sappenfield at USF is working on that, FPQC, because we want to develop a model that could work rather than just make every hospital have to figure it out on their own or every health plan figure it out. So we're moving along with that pilot, and we'll be able to communicate what we've learned from that, and then Dr. Sappenfield will help us get the word out around the state. But if you'd like any interim information, please call my staff, Alicia Coley. Mm-hmm. On our staff, Dr. Coley is working very closely with that, and she can let you know progress. I know they've already had training at the hospital. They've already tested their billing, because we had to actually build billing codes and things like that from the fee-for-service side. So there's been a lot of progress made, and if you have any specific questions, we'd be happy to talk to you about it.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that. It's something we'd love to be helpful with. Mm-hmm. Another question I had is regarding performance improvement projects. Are those listed somewhere on the agency's website, like which plan is doing which one? And the other question I had is, do all plans, is everybody working on dental, is everybody working on whatever that particular PIP is, or are they plan specific?
The plans may have PIPs on anything they like. However, two are required in the current contracts, and one is dental, mm-hmm. and one is the birth outcomes in early child.
And do those change annually?
They're set in the contract as for the duration of this contract,
okay.
Right? And if you have any suggestions on changes on that, we'd be happy to hear that.
And then are the outcomes of the PIPs, you said that shared as agreed to by the plan, so there's nowhere to say here's where they were and then after the PIP, here's where we are on this particular measure?
They're tied to specific HEDIS measures, which are reported, so you would be able to see that. But if there were some specifics about, say, you wanted to know how the dental sealant in schools program worked,
sure.
for one school and for one plan in one area, then with their permission, we could share that or perhaps put you directly in touch with them.
Okay. I know I have another one, but I'll let somebody else go while I find it.
Well, please call us if you think of it later.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Anyone in the audience?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next on the agenda is Dee Dee Pickle and David Nam, and they're doing a presentation on grievance and appeals process and fair hearing.
All right. We have some very exciting changes as a result of a federal rule published last year and some additional changes in Florida law. We're going to be talking to you today about the statewide Medicaid managed care grievance and appeals system and the fair hearing overview. So we'll give you just an overview of the grievance and appeal system requirements and then some basics on filing complaints and requesting a Medicaid fair hearing. On slide 4, The requirements for the grievance and appeal system come from the federal government, from Florida statutes, and they're also in our statewide Medicaid managed care contract. Now, last year, the federal CMS published a final rule on Medicaid managed care and the Child Health Insurance Program. And if you were here or you called in for the last Medical Care Advisory Committee, Beth Kidder gave a brief overview of the Medicaid managed care final rule. One of the main changes in the final rule is to the grievance and appeal system. The other change last year was to Florida law, and that was to transition responsibility for Medicaid fair hearings, some of them, to the Agency for Healthcare Administration. Now, to start you out on a level playing field, I'll warn you immediately that the terminology changes. And it, we are sticking really here with talking about the managed care terminology, but if you were to go back and look at the rules that are around the fair hearing system for the fee-for-service system, those are still using the old term, so just keep that in mind. An adverse benefit determination, this is a new term. sorry, I've got a frog in my throat. This is the denial or limited authorization of a requested service or a reduction, suspension, or termination of a previously authorized service. This used to be called an action. A notice of adverse benefit determination, you'll start to see that abbreviated as NABD, is the notice that the health plan sends when they make an adverse benefit determination. A plan appeal, we used to just call these in shorthand appeals. We're calling them for consistency purposes plan appeals now. That's the review by the health plan of an adverse benefit determination. And then last but not least on this one, an expedited appeal is basically a fast plan appeal. Now, once the plan appeal has been completed, enrollee will get a notice of plan appeal resolution, and that's the written notice that comes from the plan to the enrollee that tells them what the end outcome is of that plan appeal. And then a few more basic terms, a complaint, that's any oral or written expression of dissatisfaction by an enrollee that's submitted to the health plan or to state agency and resolved by close of business the following business day. If it's not resolved by close of business the following business day, it becomes a grievance. And then last, a Medicaid fair hearing. That's the opportunity for an enrollee to present his or her case to a reviewing authority if the enrollee feels the agency or the health plan has made an error in their case. So I'm going to take you through each of these definitions for complaint and grievance and appeal and Medicaid fair hearing and just give you an example to go along with them. So I told you a complaint is any oral or written expression of dissatisfaction by an enrollee that's submitted to the health plan. An enrollee can file these at any time. And the key here is that it does have to be resolved by the end of the day, the next business day. So if I called my health plan today, I made a complaint, they would have to resolve that by the end of the day tomorrow. So for our example, we have Ms. Jones, and she receives home-delivered meals, but she doesn't like her home-delivered meals provider because she thinks the meals are too salty. So she submits this complaint to her health plan. Do I need to give me a cue? All right. The health plan offers to replace her home-delivered meals provider with a different provider in the network, and she's satisfied, so her complaint's resolved. If the health plan couldn't resolve her complaint by the close of business the following next day, then it would become a grievance. A little bit of the difference between the complaints and grievances, we receive a good bit more data on grievances and the plan adverse benefit determinations from health plans. They do some regular reporting on those. The complaints are a lower level of an example of a grievance, but, you know, typically we hope things will be resolved pretty quickly. A grievance is, again, an expression of dissatisfaction about any matter other than an adverse benefit determination. They also can be filed at any time. The health plan in this case has 90 days to resolve a grievance. Now, the enrollee does not have to file a complaint before they file a grievance. They can just call and go straight to a grievance. You have to cue me so I catch up. And then I told you about, you know, if that's filed, if the complaint doesn't get resolved, then that becomes a grievance. So for our grievance examples, Mr. Smith had an appointment with his cardiologist. And the receptionist at the cardiologist's office was new and very rude to him. So Mr. Smith filed a grievance with his health plan about the rude encounter he had with that receptionist. His health plan contacted the cardiologist's office to discuss the rude staff member with that office. His health plan contacted him to let him know they had spoken to the provider and they counseled him on any other cardiologists that were available in the network. So in this case, his grievance was resolved. End of story with that. Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. I'm failing miserably on advancing the slides. My job has been taken away. All right, adverse benefit determination. Sometimes the health plan may deny an enrollee's request for a particular service, or they'll limit it, suspend it, or terminate a previously authorized service. When they do, this is called an adverse benefit determination. And whenever the plan makes an adverse benefit determination, they must notify the enrollee in writing about that decision. The notice of adverse benefit determination is mailed to the enrollee by the health plan with standard authorization decisions within 7 days of that request for service. You should know with notice of adverse benefit determinations that plans are all required to use a standard agency template. So they'll be put on the plan's letterhead, but the content and the order of information that goes into the letter is basically the same for each one. The time frame can be extended for up to 7 days if the enrollee asks or the provider requests for an extension, and the health plan has to justify how the extension is in the enrollee's interest. And then the time frame can be shortened to 48 hours if the standard time frame could seriously jeopardize the enrollee. So on slide 13, we give you all the elements that have to be included in a notice of adverse benefit determination. We also include these same elements in the plan's contract. Not really a question of whether they're in there because we do mandate the specific template and we make sure all of these pieces are in there. But it's going to give the enrollee the decision that got made and why the decision was made. It notifies them about their right to get a free copy of their case record and the medical necessity criteria. It tells them about their right to request a plan appeal and a Medicaid fair hearing and the process for exercising those rights if they want to. It tells them the circumstances under which a plan appeal can be expedited and how to request it. And then the enrollee's right to have benefits continue pending the resolution of a plan appeal and how to request that, and the circumstances under which the enrollee may be required to pay for the cost of those services. So after the notice of adverse benefit determination has come, then the enrollee has the option to go to a plan appeal. Now, one of the bigger changes in the whole grievance and appeal systems process, it used to be that once somebody received their notice of action letter, they could either go to a plan appeal or they could go to a Medicaid fair hearing. They had the choice of either. The system now requires that enrollee has to use the grievance process first before they can go to a Medicaid fair hearing. The appeal process first before they can go to a Medicaid fair hearing. So if they want to choose to go through the plan appeal process to get to the fair hearing portion, if they disagree with the adverse benefit determination, they can file a plan appeal at that point. The enrollee has to file that plan appeal within 60 days of the date of the adverse benefit determination. So if that decision was made on, I don't actually know what today's date is, but if it were made on January 1st, it would be 60 days from January 1st is the deadline for them to make their plan appeal file. And then the health plan, once they receive it, they have 30 days to resolve the plan appeal. So as an example, Mrs. Jones' doctor determined she needs a wheelchair because she has trouble walking and standing. Mrs. Jones' health plan denied her request for a wheelchair and sent her a notice of adverse benefit determination. And then Mrs. Jones filed a plan appeal. Her health plan reviewed and resolved her plan appeal within that 30-day time frame, and the health plan overturned its original decision and provided the wheelchair. Now, sometimes things are more dire than that, and the enrollee's health is at risk, and in those cases, we have an expedited plan appeal. These have to be resolved much more quickly than the standard 30 days. We sometimes call them a fast appeal in the letters when they come because it's a much easier, less complex way of saying it. The enrollee has to file their expedited appeal within 60 days of the date of the adverse benefit determination, but the health plan has to resolve it now within 72 hours. And this seems like a, maybe seem like a minor change, but the previous wording in the managed care rule before they changed it was 3 business days. And so if you think about the difference between 72 hours and 3 business days when the clock starts on a Friday, that is several days. So that's a pretty big difference. If the health plan determines that the appeal doesn't actually need to be expedited, it just goes back into the standard appeal time frame, so it would be the full 30 days. So we have an example here. Mr. Smith just visited his dentist, and his dentist referred him to an oral surgeon to have his wisdom teeth removed. After his exam with the oral surgeon determined that he needs all 4 wisdom teeth removed and scheduled surgery for the later the week. 5 days before the surgery, his health plan sent him a notice of adverse benefit determination, informing him the plan would not cover the wisdom teeth removal surgery. Now, because his surgery is scheduled for 5 days from now, Mr. Smith filed an expedited appeal with his health plan. And then following his expedited appeal request, the health plan reviewed and resolved his appeal within 72 hours. In this case, though, the health plan upheld its original decision and denied the wisdom teeth removal surgery. And that finally brings us to the point of a Medicaid fair hearing. In that letter, when they receive notice about the plan's decision on an appeal or an expedited appeal, they're going to receive a notice of plan appeal resolution, and that notice of plan appeal resolution will give them, again, the same information about how to file a Medicaid fair hearing if they choose to do so. So the enrollee can request a fair hearing when that process is completed in the following circumstances: after they receive the notice that the health plan is upholding their adverse benefit determination, or if the health plan fails to meet the notice and timing requirements for following a plan appeal. So remember, they have 30 days. Let's say they go over 30 days. At that point, that's considered resolved, and the enrollee can go ahead and make a request for fair hearing at that point. The parties to the Medicaid fair hearing include the health plan, the enrollee, and the enrollee's authorized representative, or the representative of the deceased enrollee's estate, and in some cases, the agency. And these are heard by a hearing officer, and the final order may be appealed by the enrollee to the District Court of Appeal. So we use, again, for this example here, we have the Medicaid fair hearing. We're sticking with Mr. Smith, who has visited his dentist and gotten an order to have his wisdom teeth removed. Kind of skipping through, it's the same scenario. But once he completes his expedited appeal request and he receives his notice, Mr. Smith can now file a Medicaid fair hearing. Now, I mentioned before continuation of benefits. If the plan's terminating or reducing a benefit, an enrollee can ask the health plan to continue the benefit while the appeal or the fair hearing is going on. For the benefits to continue during a plan appeal, the enrollee or their authorized representative needs to file the appeal in the required time frame, and they need to ask for continuation of benefits on or before either of the two following, within 10 days after the notice of adverse benefit determination is mailed, or the intended effective date of the proposed adverse benefit determination. So whichever is later. So sometimes you may have something that's more immediate, but you may have, I received a notice that my service is going to end on the 7th of February. And in that case, it would be either 10 days from today or the 7th of February, whichever is the later. All right, and then for benefits to continue during the fair hearing, the enrollee has to ask for the fair hearing and continuation of benefits within 10 days. On slide 21, there's just a really brief table for you. It just sums up all of the filing and resolution timeframes to give you at a quick glance the type of action, and then how many days the enrollee has to file and how long the health plan has to resolve the issue. I'll hit on a couple things on 22, and then I'm going to move out of David's way, and he's going to talk about the fair hearings. Again, the enrollee is entitled to a free copy of his or her case file, and the notice letters will give them information on how they can request that. There are some limitations on which health plan staff can make decisions about grievances and appeals. So when a service is first requested, there will be someone who at the health plan makes a decision to deny. And if they do and that is appealed, then a different person needs to make the decision about the appeal. So if Dr. Smith made the decision the first time, then it needs to be somebody other than Dr. Smith making the decision for the plan appeal. There are some limited times when people can request the fair hearing before the health plan finishes its appeals, as I said, when they've taken too much time to do the plan appeal resolution. If the health plan decides to delay processing a grievance or a plan appeal, they do have to notify the enrollee in writing. And the health plan has to keep some pretty detailed records on each grievance and plan appeal, which have to be accessible to the agency. And then again, as I said before, the plans have to use the agency's standard notice templates for the notice of adverse benefit determination and the notice of plan appeal resolution. We formerly only had a template for the notice of what is now the notice of adverse benefit determination, but now we're doing for both the resolution letters and the notice letters. All right, and then David is going to talk about changes in the Medicaid fair hearing process.
Thank you very much, Dee Dee. I'm David Nam. I'm the chief of the Office of Fair Hearings, which has been newly established here at the Agency for Healthcare Administration. The office is established pursuant to changes in the law 409.285 per n 2 of the Florida statutes, which transfers certain fair hearing responsibility from the Department of Children and Families Office of Appeal Hearings to ACA. There are certain remaining fair hearing responsibilities that the DCF will have after March 1. Those are identified on the next slide, I believe. Let's see. I think Dee Dee covered pretty well the transition from the notices of action, which are the former vehicle for notifying persons of fair hearing rights, both in the managed care environment and in the fee-for-service environment. In the managed care environment, we'll now be dealing with the notices of adverse benefit determination and the notices of a plan appeal resolution. So in order to facilitate a clean transition as of the March 1 date, the entity that is identified in the notice will control where the individual requests their fair hearing. So for example, if a notice of action was issued on the 28th of February identifying the DCF as the entity that is responsible for providing the hearing, even 90 days forward beyond the March 1 transition date, that hearing would continue to be within the jurisdiction of the Department of Children and Families Office of Appeal Hearings. Then, as regards a notice that goes out March 1 or thereafter, particularly in regards to the health plans, the notice of plan appeal resolution will identify ACA's intake office. So this is another piece that folks need to pay attention to when requesting the fair hearing. The ACA intake will be through the Bureau of RPA Recipient and Provider Assistance, and we will utilize their infrastructure in order to handle the fair hearing request telephonically, and then we will also rely upon the Medicaid Fair Hearing Unit within that Bureau for purposes of further vetting those hearing requests and making sure that components that are required in order to proceed with the hearing request are present before the hearing request would be transferred over to ACCA's Office of Fair Hearings for purposes of acknowledgement of the hearing request, assignment of the hearing officer, and scheduling of the subsequent fair hearing. Okay? So, moving along with regard to the remaining responsibilities that the DCF will have for fair hearings after March 1, I just addressed the fact that notices that occurred prior to March 1 that identified DCF would continue to go regardless of the subject matter, but subject matter jurisdiction of fair hearings after March 1, primarily the DCF will have the financial eligibility fair hearings regarding Medicaid. So that will be a significant component of fair hearing responsibility, consistent with the administrative workings of that agency in reviewing Medicaid applicants for the program. The financial considerations, if they generate fair hearing, that will remain with the Office of Appeal Hearings at DCF. Next, we've got the fair hearings that might pertain to the I-budget waiver with the Agency for Persons with Disabilities. So all of your I-budget-related fair hearing matters will continue with the Office of Appeal Hearings at DCF. Pre-admission screening and resident review required under the Social Security Act at 1917 paren E paren 7 will remain with the DCF. And also the resident transfers and discharges mandated by Section 400.0255 of the Florida statutes will remain with the DCF. Everything else pretty much comes to ACCA for fair hearing after the mandatory plan appeal is completed, either by virtue of the plan issuing its notice of plan appeal resolution, or if there is some difficulty resulting from lack of adherence to required time frames. Okay? And then, what's that?
Yep, you covered that.
Okay. So then, I've provided some information regarding the contacts for the Agency for Healthcare Administration. This could potentially be a little confusing, and so we're trying to make sure that we have a great deal of outreach regarding the intake process for fair hearings. But again, we feel very confident that this process will be successful, because the infrastructure that is associated with ACCA's enrollment broker and choice counseling operation, as well as plan-related complaint processes, have all been processed through this intake unit since the inception of the statewide managed care program, and those folks have a great deal of experience in making that system work. Finally, there will be a second layer of review through the fair hearing unit within that bureau, and then ultimately our office, which we have provided our mailing address and our email address. You can contact us if you have a question related to a specific fair hearing. The idea is we are wanting to make sure that our office is dealing primarily and completely with active fair hearings and not so much the generalized questions that might better be fielded by the intake unit. Okay? And then there's a statistical document here that simply indicates over time the breakdown of the fair hearings that are generated by the managed care program, and the smaller number at the top of each of the bars indicating the fee-for-service hearings that are being generated. There are additional subject areas that are generating some fair hearings. Direct payments can result in fair hearing. Good cause disenrollments can result in fair hearing opportunity. Generally speaking, those are relatively de minimis number of fair hearing requests, and so in any event, that is my overview for the program. Thank you. Yes, sir. Mr. Griegas.
Is there a process in place for notification of a plan when an enrollee is represented by counsel? And if so, can you expand on what that process is?
Certainly. And one thing that I omitted to mention, we have been going through a rulemaking.
Can you read that question for the record?
Sure. I think Mr. Griegas with the Ackerman firm asked a question pertaining to how would, I guess, plan counsel be made aware of the fact that a recipient is represented by counsel? Okay. So we have a rule that is going through the rulemaking process at this time. That rule is 59G-1.100. Medicaid fair hearings, and it is the procedural rule that will govern fair hearings before ACCA, okay? That rule requires that attorneys file notice of appearance as soon as they become associated with a case, or if an attorney is to make a request or has made a request for a fair hearing on behalf of a recipient or enrollee, they would be required to file a written designation of authorized representative in addition to ultimately filing a notice of appearance in the matter itself.
Has any thought been given to a minimum time frame? Because I think what the situation that we've encountered previously is that an enrollee may take on counsel the day before or the day of the actual fair hearing, and then the plan is caught, you know, by surprise as to the representation. And I was just curious as to a minimum time for filing that notice of appearance has been considered.
Thank you. Off the top of my head, do you want me to restate his question? Off the top of my head, I don't know that there is a specific point in a fair hearing process at which, if you're going to have counsel, you have to, have that counsel on board and have a notice of appearance. And under the rule, counsel could file that notice of appearance at the hearing itself. Now, that could and quite possibly would lead to a finding of good cause by the hearing officer that there is a need to extend the date for the hearing. But that, in my mind, would be the mechanism for addressing that issue.
Quick question. Thanks, David. You mentioned the rule that's in development right now.
Yes.
Could you give a little update maybe on the timeline for that or when you expect that to be officially proposed?
Yes. So the rule has been tracking through the rulemaking process. It has gotten some final approvals on some important edits, and it is still routing for final approval for publication as a proposed rule. We're very hopeful that that could occur within the next several weeks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And just one more question. You mentioned the outreach work that you're doing and the system you have in place with the intake process, and I think you also mentioned that there could be confusion, and we definitely share that concern. I'm stating the obvious when I say there's a lot going on with healthcare and Medicaid right now, so we are concerned that this might not get the attention, or, you know, people might be looking at other things than this huge change. So with the outreach efforts you're doing, I think it would be so helpful if, like, PowerPoints like this could be posted maybe on the Medicaid recipient landing page, or and anything that, I mean, it's not just that recipients have access to, but other groups, because I know we refer a lot of our networks to your materials, so it's great to have a source on your website that kind of lays out exactly what's going on, maybe similar to what is happening with the behavioral analysis switch that's actually happening today. So anything we can help with that, and if you could share maybe some plans that you have on that, that would be great.
Sure. So with regard to outreach, we have provided, again, working with the Bureau of Recipient and Provider Assistance, a web page that identifies how persons would request fair hearing as of the March 1 date. I know that with the plans, there's been significant communications ongoing with regard to the migration to the notices of adverse benefit determination and the notices of a plan appeal, and we're great, you know, very grateful for that partnership and the ability to work with the plans so that they can educate their enrollees as to their rights and opportunities regarding fair hearing. We have been utilizing the Medicaid provider notice network. I think we have a winter bulletin that includes some information regarding the new fair hearing process. In addition, we've been working very closely with our colleagues over at the Office of Appeal Hearings at DCF, and they are going through some of their own notification processes in order to help people to understand their more limited set of responsibilities in the post-March 1 environment. And we have been meeting with them to develop protocols for how it is that, you know, fair hearings that, you know, everyone will do their best and things will still go to the wrong place. And so then how we will reroute those things to get them to the right place in a timely fashion is a matter of, you know, the utmost interest and concern. And so we have been working closely with them to identify different fact patterns and to figure out how we will address, you know, those on a going forward.
David, it sounds like you've been doing a great job, and it sounds like it's all coming together with respect to the transition, so you'd be congratulated on that. I do have one other question. Since the rule is in process right now,
okay,
is there anything you can tell us about tweaks to the discovery process, or are we operating on the assumption that it's just as it was before in terms of the protocols and procedures in place?
So I think there was mention made in Dee Dee's presentation about some of the rights that are afforded recipients and enrollees to obtain information in their case file, as well as information pertaining to the basis upon which the item that's the subject of the fair hearing has been resolved. So there is the opportunity to request information. Under our rule, hearing notices would certainly require advance exchange of, you know, documents and whatnot, so that we're not having, you know, hearing by ambush. People are having a full and fair opportunity to be made aware of documents that are relevant ahead of the hearing and have access to those documents at the time of the hearing. Now, your question dealt with discovery, and the vast majority of the fair hearings, in fact, my understanding is somewhere 95% are pro se, okay? So a few pro se litigants delve deeply into the rules of civil procedure and the discovery process. There are some, and the discovery provisions that are available under the rules of civil procedure are made available to litigants in fair hearings. Okay, we would anticipate that counsel would be the ones to make the most use of those, and there are subpoena powers in addition to the provisions in the discovery rules. Okay.
Yes, sir. I'm Michael Lockwood. Regarding eligibility or denial of eligibility on financial,
yes,
financial considerations, where would the fair hearing be conducted, by DCF or?
Yep. So the DCF, of course, retains the responsibility to make financial eligibility determinations regarding Medicaid applicants for participation in the program. And if there is a determination that is, I guess, inconsistent with the applicant's desire to participate in the program, they could take, I don't know exactly what those notices look like because I don't know that I've ever seen one. I think that there's a specific form that the DCF uses to tell people what the outcome of their financial eligibility determination is, and it's my understanding that that form continues to identify the DCF as the entity that will handle the financial eligibility determinations with regard, the fair hearing opportunity on that point. From time to time, you have a situation where there can be an eligibility determination coupled with a services-related determination. And in those instances, we would continue to anticipate that the DCF would dispose of the eligibility issue prior to our office taking up a service-related issue. Okay.
Thank you, David. Next on the agenda is the home and community-based waiver consolidation presentation, and that will be presented by Chantel Carter-Jones.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Chantel Carter-Jones, and I'm the administrator for the Program Authorities section. And part of our initiative this year is to seek legislative approval to consolidate a number of our home and community-based waivers into the SMMC program. So I'm going to give you a little presentation about that today. I apologize for those who have heard this before, but hey, more information is always good. So the goal of the initiative is to transition individuals who are enrolled in the traumatic brain and spinal cord injury waiver, the Project Aid Care waiver, and the Adult Cystic Fibrosis waiver into the SMMC program completely, so they would receive their home and community-based services via the long-term care waiver. I'd make a note here that these individuals receive their acute care services through the 1115 MMA waiver, so through MMA plans already, and so to the extent that so they already have an exposure to the SMMC program. Our intent with this initiative is to leverage the services and structures and the heightened case management and support process that is in place under statewide managed care to the benefit of the individuals that it serves. They would end up with a more simplified access to Medicaid services, less people, less different processes and structures involved. Greater consistency would be a result of that. They would also get improved case management and care coordination, which is an inherent benefit to a managed care system, which improves the continuum of care and is a benefit of a more integrated or unified delivery system. They would also be able to access the additional benefits available under the SMMC system, so specifically the long-term care expanded benefits, and the more robust service package that is available under the long-term care waiver versus the current waiver service packages. make a note here that the point of this really is not an effort to attempt to reduce access to either Medicaid itself or to the services that are available. It is far more to leverage the benefits of the SMMC system for those individuals. So a little bit of demographic information on each of the waivers. The traumatic brain and spinal cord injury waiver has approximately 350 individuals enrolled and approximately 350 on the waiting list. They currently require a nursing facility level of care to enroll in the TBI SCI waiver, and if we made no change, these individuals can choose to move over to the long-term care waiver. They meet the requirements for the long-term care waiver if they so choose at this point. And so some of them have engaged in the long-term care waiver waitlist or have chosen to enroll in the long-term care program. So to these people, from an eligibility standpoint, there is limited difference once moving from one waiver to the other. Next slide. The adult cystic fibrosis waiver population, there's approximately 140 individuals enrolled. There is not currently a wait list, although there are provisions for one. Research and assessment shows that the population is relatively stable, and so we don't anticipate the number to particularly change over time. These individuals have a hospital level of care, which is obviously different to the current long-term care waiver, and so the goal would be to create an eligibility group, which was made possible via the home and community-based settings rule that CMS finalized in 2014, which allowed different access points to a single waiver. We would create an eligibility group for this particular population, similar to the requirements to enroll in the current adult cystic fibrosis waiver, that would allow access to the long-term care waiver on the basis of that level of care, having a diagnosis of cystic fibrosis, and the age requirements would be similar. Next slide is the Project AIDS Care Waiver. There are approximately 8,000 individuals enrolled. The vast majority of those only receive case management, so there are only about 400 to 500 individuals enrolled in the Project AIDS Care Waiver who receive an additional home and community-based service. They are currently required to either meet hospital or nursing facility level of care, and so this is a little bit different to both the ACF and the TBI waiver insofar as we would seek to maintain Medicaid eligibility for these individuals by creating an eligibility group under the 1115 Managed Medical Assistance waiver. That would maintain their access to Medicaid, and for those who don't require or are not currently enrolled in not currently receiving additional home and community-based services, that would maintain their access to drugs and their PCP and all their primary services that they currently receive through the MMA program. And those who do require additional home and community-based services and meet the level of care requirements would be able to receive those via the long-term care waiver. Again, to reiterate, this is not an exercise or an attempt to eliminate services for any of these populations. And so to that extent, we did a service comparison between the current waivers and the long-term care waiver. And part of the handouts that you have is a little bit more information on that analysis. The vast majority of the services are directly comparable in one format or another. They might be called something slightly different, but the components of the service are the same. There are a couple that are slightly different, and our initial analysis shows that they can be adequately replaced with current services, either through the MMA program or through the long-term care waiver. And on the next slide, there is a table that illustrates that. Again, you have additional information in your packet, so you can see the full description of the current services. So for the PAC waiver, restorative massage is not covered under the long-term care waiver or as part of MMA, and we believe that that could be replaced by physical therapy or chiropractic services as appropriate. TBI, an SEI waiver, life skills training, and we believe that could be replaced by occupational physical therapy, personal adjustment counseling for that population too, and we believe that could be replaced by behavioral management, the adult cystic fibrosis population, massage therapy would be replaced by physical therapy, and nutritional supplements would be replaced by the prescribed drug service. And to the extent that an element is not currently covered, we would look to either include that as a state plan benefit for individuals with adult cystic fibrosis. So primarily it's the higher saline solution. So the higher rate or dilution of saline solution. So we would seek to just add that to the PDL so it would be covered under there. Part of this, obviously, we went through a large transition when we consolidated the largely aged and disabled waivers when we started the long-term care program, but the transition process is of key to making this effort a success. And so to that end, we have paid a lot of attention about, you know, learning lessons from the past and any particular considerations we need to make as a result of this transition. And just to sort of give you an idea in context, when we transitioned originally, we were talking 40, 50,000 people. We're talking probably less than 1,000 people in total who would have to who would be receiving services via a different program to what they are to how they are currently receiving services. The transition process has been designed to facilitate understanding early and often. There are a number of touch points or additional touch points that are available to transitioning populations, including additional notices, choice counselling that includes face-to-face. We bring in other partners, for example, their current case managers and other operational partners, DOH particularly for the TBI and ACF populations, to ensure that this isn't a surprise for anybody who is impacted, and help counsel them through making the right plan choice and making the right decision for the future of their services. We really want people to make an affirmative and appropriate choice, so not to have to default to auto-assignment, particularly those who are already receiving services, for those who are already receiving services under MMA. Unless they make an affirmative change to their MMA services, their MMA plan is not going to change. And so those who are now coming into an atmosphere where comprehensive plans and other things are available to them that they haven't been exposed to before, we want to make sure that they really understand the options open to them as against their needs. As I'm sure you're all aware, plans are contractually required to ensure continuity of care during the transition period, and we have successfully worked with plans in the past to ensure people are able to maintain relationships with providers and existing caregivers, etc., as appropriate, and we plan to do that through this transition too. And our goal is to complete the transition by January 1st, 2018. We have conducted some outreach with various stakeholders in relation to this group, and there have been a couple of questions and so on that have sort of come up consistently. One has been that the level to which plans have experience with individuals with these levels of acuity. And so this becomes particularly important when you're talking about continuity of care moving forward. And so, as I mentioned twice now, the plans do have, or at least MMA plans and comprehensive plans, do have experience with these individuals from an acute medical service perspective. And again, those who are long-term care only currently are responsible for individuals who are aged and disabled, or many of whom have a high acuity. And so plans are very comfortable with individuals who have more specific needs and have procedures, etc., in place to facilitate meeting their need. For those individuals particularly who have a particular interest in stability in pharmacy services and PCP services and things like that. Again, unless someone makes an affirmative change to their MMA plan, those core acute services will not be impacted by this transition. And so falling back on the transition process and ensuring that people are making an affirmative choice, knowing all of the factors that go into that, again, is something that we're very much focused on. There are some other considerations that we've taken on board. One would be, given that the ACF population is a different level of care, how will we deal with that population in relation to the wait list that exists for the long-term care program? And so that's why the stability of that population is important. We have a number of thoughts about how we may need to deal with that, but again, going back to the principle that the concept of this is not to effectively bar a population who currently has a certain level of access to Medicaid, we certainly appreciate that there is a disconnect between the hospital level of care and the nursing facility level of care, and then looking at ways how we can ameliorate that for the ACF population. For the TBI population, we have run an analysis on where they would score in the wait list, in the long-term care wait list, and our results show that they would score high enough to be within the release range, and so they would not effectively be they would not have reduced access over what they have now if they were to try and attempt to enroll in the TBI wait list. And so we think they actually may be able to, or new individuals would be able to access Medicaid services faster than they would be under the current program. I think that is it from my. That seemed very short. I think that is it from my perspective. Those are the major elements that we have considered, and certainly anything else that people in this group or other stakeholder groups have brought to bear, we've included in our program analysis and including in our operations as we navigate through this. So at this point, I'll open up for questions.
I have a question. Currently, the tool that's used to screen individuals for long-term care managed care does not take into account or weight the factors of their diagnoses when it comes to putting them in long-term care managed care. And how do you consider that population being, combined with another population that may have diagnoses similar, but yet it's not weighted as a higher score to get somebody to a higher higher on the wait list?
So if I, just to make sure I understand your question, the current process for access to the long-term care waiver is based much more on acuity of risk as opposed to diagnosis.
Yes.
And so you're saying if we start bringing in populations that traditionally have been looked at on the basis of diagnosis, how is that going to comport with the acuity of risk?
Yes.
Okay, so for the long-term care population, through our initial analysis, that has appeared to for the TBI population, sorry, that appears to have not been an issue insofar as the acuity of those individuals using the criteria using the assessment tool to gain access to the long-term care wait list hasn't proved to be an issue in that sense. The ACF population we're going to have to handle differently in some format, and so we are looking at ways to do that, whether that be reserving capacity or having a separate form that doesn't separate sort of avenue to be released onto the waiver that doesn't adversely impact the ACF population. And for the PAC population, the principle would be the same as the TBI population. Those who need services or who meet a level of need to require home and community-based services should be released in due course, as would anybody who is in current aged and disabled population. And so in that sense, we're actually leveling the playing field for those who would be attempting to enroll to receive home and community-based long-term care services. Does that make sense?
I think it does. I am, and I may be mistaken, but I thought that the PAC waiver eligibility was currently only hospital level of care. So it is both.
Yes.
Okay. I'm just having a hard time in my mind reconciling the hospital sort of episodic acute care versus nursing home long-term care and how you look at those two things equally with a population that historically has only been looked at for long-term care and how you consider combining those populations together and weight different people based on, you know, their diagnosis.
So I'll just say that the PAC population and the TBI population are both voluntary currently for long-term care. So as we've stated, we're not concerned in that regard. As far as the ACF population, as Chantel has indicated, we are going to have to create a specific target group in our long-term care waiver application that identifies that population being eligible using a different level of care screening process. And I would just offer to you that we work closely with your staff on a monthly basis, and so we can continue to work through some of these more operational questions that you're asking and considerations throughout the implementation if this is picked up by the legislature and ultimately passed. So these are things that it's helpful for you to bring to our attention, and we can work through as we move forward.
And just one more question. Sorry. I have a list I'll send you.
That'd be great.
at work. If there's specified funding associated with these waivers, federal funding or, you know, associated GR funding that is specifically for individuals in each of these three waivers that you're going to combine together, will it be expected somehow that those dollars associated with those particular waiver diagnoses will be required to be spent on the individuals for which they're currently being used, or will it all be bundled into just the long-term care waiver?
Unless the legislature directs us to do anything different, the LBR that we submitted was to have the funding transferred to ACA, and it would be included in the long-term care budget.
So there wouldn't be any expectation that in today's world, and I don't know what the budget is, but say there's $10 million for the PAC waiver services in its current format, and then that $10 million gets bundled into the long-term care managed care, would there be an expectation that $10 million would still be expected to be serving the PAC waiver individuals or the subsequent dollars associated with those other individual waivers? Would it be bundled together, or would it be considered to be silos that different populations would pull down different dollars?
I think so. This is a transitioning population, and again, as Chantel has said repeatedly, we don't see this as a opportunity for reduction in services. It's not the purpose of this. So the funding that's currently being utilized to serve that population will transfer into long-term care. The plans will be responsible, will take over all the care planning activities, and we expect to see continuity of care among the population and those dollars being used to provide services as needed and as previously received for the population. So this is more of a transition. So maybe I'm missing your question, but perhaps we can have further discussions on it. Yeah. Okay. Good.
Any other questions?
Thank you. I'm Cindy Snyder with Veeve Healthcare. With the PAC waiver, and you're creating this eligibility group under the 1115 waiver so that none of those folks lose Medicaid coverage during this transition. So is that eligibility category limited to just those approximately 8,000 who were already in the PAC waiver, or could a new person coming into Medicaid come in to Medicaid through that eligibility category?
The eligibility requirements would be the same as they are for admission, or similar to what they are for admission to the PAC waiver as it stands. So there wouldn't be, if you're asking if there would be a cap, you would have to meet the requirement, and if you met the requirements, you would be able to be eligible to enroll in Medicaid.
Okay, I was just wanting to make sure it wasn't limited to only the people in the PAC waiver already, that people coming into Medicaid, like they have always come into the PAC waiver, can come in just using this doorway.
Yes, and that would be true for all of the waivers. Yep. We transition those who are currently there, and then the process remains the same. It's just in a different vehicle.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay, last on the agenda is a subcommittee going forward comment period by Siobhan.
Thank you, Carla. So before we began today's MCAC meeting, we did have a joint meeting of all of the MCAC subcommittee members. And during that time, we presented to the subcommittee some changes in leadership and chairs of several of the groups. And for your benefit, I will just go through and say that for the Behavioral Health and Substance Use Disorder subcommittee team, Erica Floyd Thomas and LaCure Reddick will be the agency staff handling that group. For the Children's Services team, we did put out a proposal to have that group merged with our dental subcommittee team, and it would have been chaired by myself and Jennifer Courtney from the agency, and I'll get back to that particular topic. And then for the HIV/AIDS group, Chantel Carter-Jones, sitting next to me, along with Karen Jacobson, would chair that subgroup. Going back to the proposal presented to the subcommittee earlier, we had a brief discussion about merging the children's group and the dental group, and did receive a little bit of feedback when we had the joint meeting. And when we went into our breakout sessions, the members of each of the respective groups, children's and dental, came together, and we had a little bit more discussion on the topic, or a lot more discussion on the topic, and there was great consensus among the group that we should continue to have a focused group on dental. And so I will be taking that back to my leadership team, and we will have further discussions on maintaining the dental subcommittee team. And in the interim between this meeting and the next meeting, we will follow up with the members of the Children's Services subcommittee team to talk about the future of that group. So just wanted to let you know where we landed. I think we had a very productive conversation when we met on a more individualized basis or on a smaller scale, and we'll continue to keep the larger MCAC group or committee members apprised of our progress in this regard.
Okay. Thank you very much. If there are no other questions, comments, this will conclude our meeting. The next medical care meeting will be held on April 25th. Thank you all for coming.